You're listening to the TrekMate Family Network.
The Battle Bridge is a proud member of the Tech Podcast Network. If it's tech, it's here. Please visit techpodcast.com.
Worf, Solus, Sue, report to the Battle Bridge. I'll join you in a moment.
Ensign, secure connector levels.
Crusher, Carteno, Gleason, report to the Battle Bridge.
Mr. Data, Mr. Worf, I have a special mission for you.
Note in ship's log that at this start time, I'm transferring command to the Battle Bridge.
You're listening to The Battle Bridge, a TNG podcast where we discuss everything about Star Trek to Next Generation. Tonight's episode is The Inner Light. I'm Colin from Warwickshire in England.
And I'm James from London, but I'm not currently in London.
Well, you can't just say that, you've got to tell them where you are.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sitting in the middle of a field in the Netherlands somewhere, because I'm on holiday, and because our record schedule was unfortunately... due to my fault, delayed by 2 weeks, I'm having to do this on holiday, and the wife's happy about it. It seems she's inside now, drinking.
And I'm Lou from Nebraska. I am in Nebraska, and I'm not drinking.
Not yet.
No, not yet. So, Colin, how are you doing, bud? We haven't talked to you for at least one episode.
I know, it's been absolutely ages, haven't it? Yeah. No, I'm really looking forward to tonight. We've had a few scheduling conflicts, basically on shifts, new work shifts. James is travelling, so we've had a few problems. But yeah, I'm looking forward to tonight. I really like this episode.
Now, Lou, let me just jump in here. First of all, apologies. There's a bit of background noise. There's a bit of bird song where I'm at. It can't really be helped. Although maybe I can put I can edit the bird song out.
Leave
it in. Leave it ambient.
It sounds great.
Yeah, or perhaps amplify it. I don't know. But Lou, the last episode that we put out with Colin, right, is that that was delayed. And the reason why that was delayed is that we had a recording issue, and then I fell ill after that, and you were waiting for me to send you a video clip of our initial thoughts, because that was what we lost in the record. And then I sent that to you, and... you immediately put out the episode, and it didn't include my initial thoughts.
Hold on. But what you said on the recording that you sent me was, well, we recorded this a long time ago. I don't remember what my thoughts are, so let's push on.
That's correct. But I was expecting that to be in the show.
That wasn't in... I thought that was in the show, because then I said, well, no, you're not going to... I'm not going to let him get away with that. And then I... pulled what we had for, because Colin started recording after his thoughts were done, and you're at the very end of your thoughts, and I think you got mine. No, I don't remember how it went, but anyway.
No, I was second. Okay, in the copy of the show that I heard, and maybe there was something wrong with my headphones or something. I don't know. Maybe it's like a stereo thing that happened. But I ended up hearing Colin. I ended up hearing like a 40-second gap, and then I heard you said, "Right on, James," and then you carried on.
Oh man! I'll have to look at that.
And I know that you got them because you ended up you actually spliced in my "I'm James from London," which was from that take, because I can hear myself, because I can hear that I'm still ill at that point.
Yeah, you could. And I was pretty ill too when I redid that setup, so I had to, I kind of told everybody what was going on. But so do you like the two guys who go together thing?
Yes, I did. I did. The thing is, Lou, because this was the... if truth be told, I don't manage to catch every episode that we put out. So when I listened, I think I must be like 4 or 5 behind, something like that. And when I listened, I didn't know whether that was put in for this show or had been previously put in and I had just missed it. So when you then emailed and said, "Hey, do you like what I did new?" I was relieved, at least, that I hadn't missed a year and a half worth of content and being a really bad co-host.
Now, that was the first time I did that, I believe, for
Excellent.
Us. It may be the second time, but I want to come up with more, so you need to come up with a few. And you can even record them. I'll just manipulate your voice. Like, you know, that's what I did with mine. So anyway, good to have you on again, Colin. And you picked a wonderful episode to talk about. So rock and roll on in.
An alien probe controls and disables Captain Picard, who wakes up as Kamin, a resident of the planet Catan. While the crew of the Enterprise tries to jar the probe's influence, Kamin leaps through the final dying decades of his homeworld in a span of approximately 20 minutes. This is in the form of an interactive ancestor simulation. This is the 25th episode of Season 5 of Star Trek The Next Generation. The original release date is June the 1st, 1992. Written by Morgan Grendel and Peter Allen Fields, directed by Peter Lorison. Guest stars include Margaret Rose as Eileen, Richard Royal as Batai, Scott Jake as the Administrator, Jennifer Nash as Maribor, with Amber Connolly in an uncredited young Maribor, Daniel Stewart, Patrick Stewart's son, as young Batai, with Logan White as the infant Batai. Patty Yusatu, I've said that wrong.
Yes, Utaki.
There you go. As Alyssa Agoa. What do you guys think of this? I said at the start that I love this episode. So what do you guys think?
I learned long ago that when you speak Japanese names, you take each syllable at a time. So it's Yasutake. And
hang on a second. What language do you not take each syllable at a time? I mean, that's just by definition, isn't it?
Not necessarily.
Klingon.
Oh, Klingon. Yeah, maybe Klingon. Okay.
Well, I stand corrected. Anyway. So, James, he likes it. What about you?
First things first. Boy, did that that synopsis of this show suck. That was a terrible synopsis. What? They even ancestor simulation? You what?
I know.
I mean, we really have to clean up some of these memory alpha posts at some point, because that's not a good one. Okay, I'm going to shock everyone here.
Oh no!
I think this is a very overrated episode of Star Trek.
And join us next week on the Lou Trek Show.
Or the Battle Bridge, as we welcome a new guest host or new co-host to the Battle Bridge. The Doctor is out of the office.
James, you do know the playout music is this episode.
I do indeed. I do. I was just watching.
He didn't pick that in his defense.
Here's the thing. I mean, when I watched Trek the first time, first run of TNG at this point, I was relatively young. I mean, I'm going to claim I was probably around 15 or so when I saw this episode first. And I was quite an immature 15-year-old. So I don't ever recall being like hit by the grandness of the story that it's attempting to portray here. And whenever I revisit it, I always feel that it's slightly, I mean, and hold on to your hat here for a sci-fi show, I think it's slightly convoluted. I don't think it's particularly well written, and I'm not entirely sure why I should care about these people. Now, on top of that, we're led to believe that Picard has this like huge life-changing story told to him. He basically lives longer as, you know, the character on the planet than he does as Captain Picard. But he just comes back as Picard, and it's like, oh, yeah, nothing's ever happened. I've had kids, had grandkids, lived a second life, but, yeah, moving on. And I don't know, I just feel that it's not as heavyweight as... I don't find there's a heavyweight episode as many people claim it to be. So I look forward to hearing a robust defense of this episode in the coming few, hour or so. So, what are your thoughts, Lou?
I wish I had my microphone on so you could see how wide my mouth was open, going, huh? What? Convoluted? The story is pretty easy. It's not much to it at all. Let's go back in time to the day that I say, hey, you know, I kind of like what Make It So has done with their review. Make It So was my first Star Trek podcast. Then came the Gamma Quadrant podcast, and I love the way they did their show with their review. It's pretty much an homage to them. And when I said I want to do a Star Trek review, I really didn't want to start with the original series. I wanted to start with TNG. And on that day, I said, there's three episodes that I really am so looking forward to reviewing. One was yesterday's Enterprise.
Fantastic episode.
The second one was this one.
Slightly overrated.
Which is another fantastic episode.
And the third one was the follow-up to this one, Lessons.
Oh, crikey.
So, I think...
They were interesting choices.
Yeah. Well, I think this is... Oh, my goodness. People brag about the City on the Edge of Forever.
Overrated
and
as well.
Yes. I think it was overrated, number one. Number two,
The City on the Edge of Forever is overrated.
It's slightly, but it is one of the best Star Treks ever created. However, I think this is better.
Okay, hang on 1 second. Let me just, I'm going to give you, just put things in context here. City on the Edge of Forever is overrated in the sense that, you know, traditionally it would be considered to be the best original series episode and possibly in the top, you know, let's say five, to be generous, of all Trek. And this episode I would consider to be overrated when people place it in the top, top one or two of TNG.
Are you going to Vegas this year?
Yes.
Yeah, you might not want to tell people who you are.
No, yeah. I'm pretty sure last time I was in Vegas, for the 50th, they had like one of these events where you had to rank all of the episodes, right? And then you could come up and you can make a defense of one episode, or you can take one down. And I can't remember what the results were. I can dig it out. But I remember being, I think I was anti-City, and I'm anti-Inner Light. Now, what I mean by that, by the way, is that... I can give you five episodes of the original series that are better than City on the Edge Forever, and I can give you 10 episodes of Next Gen that are better than Inner Light.
Spock's Brain.
Yeah. No, not Spock's Brain.
Spock's Brain. Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah. Wow. Okay, so anybody who's going to Star Trek Las Vegas this year, I would like you to send me some information that you're going, and I'm going to supply you with some wanted dead or alive posters with James' picture on it, and you post it up there at Star Trek Las Vegas, and we'll see if we get them picked off. You're crazy.
And also, to address your earlier point, James said that, like, he wakes up and goes, yeah, I had a life, I had kids, moving on. He doesn't. This comes back in other episodes. You know, he references the profound experience he's had on him in other episodes.
Well, Lessons. That's why I say the follow-up to this one. But he didn't come back. He was completely confused. Dr. Crusher, right? He had to remember who she is, remember who he is.
Okay, let me also point out something, and again, bad about the episode. And it's something that I have brought up many times before. Troy's not in this episode. You would have thought that after having lived an entirety of, you know, a lifetime and have your entire perception of reality shattered, you might need a counsellor. You know, maybe. But it's not that. Riker comes round and goes up to him at the end and goes, yep, you're right. Yep, sure. And that seems to be the emotional takeaway from the episode.
No, that's just Picard being the stoic captain. You know, it's like when he had to have his heart transplant. Did he want people to know he was having a heart transplant because of his image as the stoic captain? It's nothing to do with, like, that he wasn't emotionally touched by it. It's to do with the fact that he has to maintain the captain persona.
I just think that if Picard had really gone through this, by the way, similar to what O'Brien goes through in Hard Time.
That is a phenomenal episode.
Yeah, it is. It's absolutely great. It really is, and it really depicts the. I mean, so realistically, what they're doing there is that they're talking about that approach of delivering justice, and that's actually a very interesting thing. And to a certain extent, they do it with they do it with Paris, right, in Voyager, but, you know, in a less good way. But they kind of have a, in that episode, they do have a sci-fi concept that they put across. In this one, I kind of just feel that it's just like, you know, hey, wouldn't it be weird if you could come, you know, live the echoes of a dying civilization, and wouldn't that be fun? And beyond that, I don't take that much away from this. Right.
This is Will Wheaton's favourite episode.
Hmm. Okay.
Mm. Okay. Yeah. I mean, it seems to me like Hard Time and this are almost the same, really.
Yeah, but Hard Time is a better episode. I'm completely sure of that.
Yeah. Miles O'Brien does really...
When you get your new host?
I mean, had you stayed on in the beginning, we wouldn't be going through this right now.
And this does
off Ewan James, who's the excellent dynamic up until now.
By the way, this does have some relatively clunky, you know, writing, right? It's like, you know, they'll have things like when his daughter finds out that the planet's dying. It's like, I have reached my conclusion that the planet's dying. So, yes, I did teach you as a scientist to look at evidence, indeed, and this is where I've got to. And it's just, it's the exposition that is put onto the screen through the dialogue. I know you have to do something because you're cutting every decade or every 15 years or so, but I don't think it's great.
Hey, in the Netherlands, is it possible the oxygen content of the air is a little less than normal?
It probably would be if it weren't for the fact it's very flat.
Because I don't think he's getting all the oxygen he would in London. Well, then again.
No, what he might be doing is because he's actually outside, he's getting too much oxygen.
That could be. The birds are affecting him.
Yeah.
Okay. So he thinks it's overrated.
Let's find out why.
Yeah. Well, first of all, we come across this interesting probe. And not very sophisticated. From what I understand... Yeah, because it looks like it's made of some kind of clay or ceramic, right?
Yeah. Well, we find out why it looks so primitive at the end of the story.
Yes. So let me ask you this: we know that the probe was sent by the planet, and it's part of the program of the probe that he sees the probe being sent by the planet. What would have been interesting or more interesting had Kamen maybe been on the design team for the probe and knew about it?
Go ahead.
Yes, that would have been interesting, but that plays into the final scenes when he says about we need to do something, and they says we already are.
Yes. Well, I we wouldn't have given that up. But I think it would have been more interesting had he'd been on the design team. He knew about the probe. He's the one that sent the probe that actually finds him in the future.
Yeah.
I think it would have been a more...
See, this is the part that I expected James to, like, tear apart, the fact that they're a primitive society who can just about manage to get a probe into space, yet they have the technological sophistication to do, like, basically the mind transference. That is the thing I expected James to imply, but he just picked everything up.
I don't think it's particularly clear what the technological level of the... of the species is.
Kind of like the Kazon can't produce water.
They're not even warp capable.
No.
Well, hang on. There must be warp capable, otherwise the probe wouldn't have got to where it did in the time it had. Well, right?
No. He says that we're only able to launch small missiles.
Yeah.
So not warp capable. Okay, so they were 1,000 years away, right? So how... Does anyone remember how far away the system was? Because it better not be more than 1,000 light years, because otherwise it would have gone through. Okay, maybe it went through a wormhole. Okay, we can give them the wormhole out.
Yeah, Vita did that.
Vita did a lot of things.
stupid things too. No, the probe was just gone was in course for 1,000 years, I guess.
Yeah, they just said that the civilization died 1,000 years ago. I don't remember mentioning how far it traveled. They just said that that they died out 1,000 years ago.
Yeah, no, but I mean, if we launch a probe right for 1,000 years, it's not gonna, you know, our probes.
Well,
how
long's Voyager been up there?
Huh? About 80 years or so.
And how far has it traveled?
It's just got to the end of the outer rim of the solar system.
So is that like 1 AU?
Yeah. No. AU is from Earth to the Sun.
So how many AUs has Voyager done?
Oh, I don't know. I'll just be picking a number out of thin air. And actually, it's not going to be 80, is it? It's going to be less than 80. 80's quite a way back. But it's...
Well, what I'm saying 60-ish. Is if their planet was a planet on the outer edge of their solar system, then it wouldn't have to be Skype. All the planets. Voyagers had to negotiate a lot of other planets to get to where it's got to. So you've got the gravitational pull from all the other planets. If their planet was the only planet, then once it escapes its sun's gravitational pull, then off it goes.
No, sure, but it doesn't go particularly fast.
No, it's basically inertia. They never actually say what sort of propulsion they've got.
Sure, no, you know, correct. But look, I don't. This doesn't come down to like a nitpick, right? That's not what this is. Whatever problems I have with the episode and not being
it's
not great,
it's
not the thousand year bit, and it's not the it doesn't really matter.
Go on, then. Moving on, Luke.
Well, the probe busts through the shields and emits a flash that takes Picard down like a bullet. And he wakes up to this strange woman next to him in bed and asks, what is this place?
Doesn't he think he's on a holodeck?
Yes.
Yeah.
He tries the badge. Comm badge isn't there. He tries computer end program, computer freeze program, Picard Enterprise, all that stuff. And none of it works.
Yeah,
and then we cut to commercial. Oh, no. Yeah, like, what the hell's wrong with you? The characters on the planet sure made it seem pretty believable that he's been there the whole time and he's just lost his head.
Yeah, I did like the fever explanation, that tried and tested trope in so many programs. You've been hallucinating, you've had a fever.
Yes, and you shouldn't go outside. You shouldn't go take a walk. You should rest in bed. But not only does he go outside, he goes outside for hours and comes back home when the crickets are out.
And by the way, one thing I do like the fact that, Picard wakes up and he's wandering around. He's trying to figure out who he is. I like this kind of like setup with a person, questioning reality, what they know to be correct. And, the way that he goes about it, I think, is relatively nice as well. Like, he mentions, he chooses his words in a way that, how do you communicate with other with other peoples, and he doesn't go, what type of radio transmitter do you use? And they don't talk about technology. It's all kept relatively vague, and even to the extent that you can see that both his wife and his best friend thinks he's a bit of a nut job every now and again when he'll mention something like, "Oh, what planet are we on?" It was also good props to the writers that when they said what planet are you on, they didn't say like, Miska 57 or anything like that.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
That one of the pet peeves that people are going to name their planet in a way that's completely inconsistent with how anyone would ever name anything.
Well, you mean like SETI Alpha 5?
Indeed.
Yeah. So what are we, Milky Way 3?
No. How can we? Come on.
I don't know what we are. What are we? I know we're third, but...
Earth.
Yes, I know we're Earth. Terran 3. Either way, if
Rocky Foot, Rocky 3.
Rocky 3. There you go. All right. Pity the fool. Anyway. Okay, so. Picard, he wakes up and he's trying to figure out where he's at. And then I like the way he tries to, he plays along. Oh, yeah, that must be it. Could you help me? What's my name? What's her name? What's this place? Where am I? And all the way along. Come on, let's put you back to bed. Oh, let's take you to the doctor. Oh, come on, you need to relax. He finally gets it out of him. They're Catan. And he finds out the planet is dying. It's a severe drought. But I liked it. What do you guys think of the tree that they plant?
The symbolic gesture.
Yes.
Yeah, yes. I mean, that made sense to me because it's something for them to all like work towards keeping the tree alive. So that made perfect sense to me. It's like something for the community to focus on aside from all the other problems that we see they have to deal with in the long run.
Yeah. That's kind of nice. So we find out his name is Catan. No, I'm sorry. His name is Kaman. The planet is Catan. He's the best iron weaver in the community, but he's the worst flute player. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Now here's one thing.
You know that flute didn't actually play.
No, I don't really think he knew how to play the flute.
No, he literally did not play. The flute did not play.
Really?
Yeah, the actual flute that he doesn't play.
Oh.
When they sold it at the Star Trek auction, I think it sold for $25,000.
Ooh.
And they asked Patrick Stewart about it, and he says in an interview, how much did he go for? And they told him, he went, wow, that's a lot of money for a flute that doesn't play.
Fascinating. All right. But one thing I do like what they do is the way they use the time thing. Like James, you said, you know, each time we go back to them, we lost a few years or a few years have passed. I kind of like that idea because, you know, they go back to the ship and he's passed out, but his brain is working overtime and they're trying to figure out a way to get the probe to disconnect from him, and everything they do backfires on him. And I like the fact that they go back to the planet and years have passed, because if they don't do that, you know, they're not going to get much story if they have a fluent time frame.
No, that's true. Let me ask you a question, though. Do you feel that it was helped? Was this episode helped to have the interaction with the probe as the teaser? Could they have not just started on the planet? Because one thing that I thought that might have been interesting is to keep this facade of, you know, what is reality going for a little bit. And I think there are a lot of episodes that do this quite well. I mean, one of my favourite episodes is, and I'm not going to remember its name, it's the one with O'Brien on DS9, where he gets replaced by a clone, and we follow as the clone for 95% of the episodes. And I think that's kind of like that's a real good kind of like twist. Whereas here, there's almost, there's, you know, the audience is always ahead of the character in a way, or maybe we're not ahead of the character, but we know what he's living on the planet is a lie. And perhaps I was just thinking, you know, had they not had that first interaction, and I obviously know that first interaction feeds into stuff that he then can put two and two together at the end of the episode, but I kind of felt that maybe allowing us to believe that maybe he isn't Jean-Luc Picard, but maybe he is on this planet and he's just had a fever dream, would have been a better way to go. I don't know what you guys' thoughts are.
Hmm.
Did the episode remove all ambiguity straight away too quickly?
No.
That's a good point. If he had just woke up out of bed with that fever and they're trying to convince him, all the while we know that they're wrong, that he is actually Kamen, but then we switch to the Enterprise with him passed out, and this probe has been attached to him for the last 10 minutes or whatever. Yeah, I think that might have been an interesting way to open the show.
Yeah, it would have been an interesting angle on it for sure.
Because that's what they do in Hard Time, isn't it? I mean, the first episode, is it the first scene you have of O'Brien being pushed in the room?
Yeah, they start striding at the deep end.
So, yeah, had they done something like that, yeah. I doubt they ever thought of it. What do you think, Colin? Any changes to the beginning that you could see like that?
Well, I don't know, because they've got to cram an awful lot into basically 45 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, they've done this in other episodes. Like, you know, in Voyager, basically the Marquee crew became Starfleet officers really quickly.
Yeah.
You know, it's not an unknown trope for them to do. Considering how much they had to get into the 45 minutes, then I didn't have a problem with them. I mean, he did question it. He didn't just accept it. He did question it. He went for the walk. He explored. It took him a long time to accept his situation.
Yeah.
In relation to how quickly we're zipping through time from his perspective. So, no, I didn't have a problem with it.
So what was the point of the scenes on the bridge? Was it just to basically remind people that might be channel hopping that they are watching Star Trek? Because
no, I don't think so. I think that was the means for which to actually let the time pass.
Yeah, because when they're on the bridge working on him, when you go back to him, then he's at a time leap.
Mm-hmm. I think that's why they did that.
Basically, it's a way of being able to, like, you know, splice together various scenes on the planet or various.
Yeah, there's one scene where they're working him on the bridge, and when you go back to him, he's aged about 10, 15 years.
Yeah. Don't mean to be rude, but it's just not getting quite close to Shades of Grey kind of territory.
Anyway, Lou.
What? Is he intentionally trying to irritate us?
James, you do know it. You know, was it 2016 you went to Vegas?
It was, yeah.
Okay, in 2016 they did a vote at Las Vegas about the fans' favourite.
It is. I know.
They voted this one.
I know, number three, wasn't it?
Yeah, number three. I know. City on the Edge of Forever, Pale Moonlight, and this one.
Okay, and can I tell you something about that? Let me just, because I was there, and at the time we did have there was this.
Obviously, you didn't vote for it.
No, actually, can I tell you what I did do? And this is something that I mentioned in the room in Vegas. And hey, if anyone was there, they will remember me doing this. But what they first do, they do like a big shuffle in order to get all of the top 10. In the 10 position, you can like remove them, you can add them and stuff like that, and then they order them. So there's a first part where they basically identify the top 10, and then there's a second part where they order them. And I think I was the last person to come in for I think I was the last person to come in that allowed kind of something to be placed into the top 10. And the one that I did put into the top 10 was one that had just been taken out of the top 10, which I thought was unfairly taken out of the top 10, which was In a Mirror Darkly. And I am a strong advocate for In a Mirror Darkly because I think it is a great episode, and I remember it. It specifically is an episode that I remembered watching on the TV. And it was the first episode of Enterprise I ever saw. And it's the real one episode that kind of got me back into Trek. I don't know how long ago it would have been, but it would have been, as that would have been broadcasting in the UK. So maybe 15 years ago now. What I used my vote on wasn't to downvote either City on the Edge of Forever or In the Light. I used my vote to upvote In a Mirror Darkly.
Hmm.
Why?
Okay.
Well, what's wrong with In a Mirror Darkly?
No, there's nothing wrong with In a Mirror Darkly. No. I like In a Mirror Darkly. It's just... Oh, boy, you seriously keep a low profile in when you go back. Okay. Mm.
Mm. And actually, sorry, this has just reminded me of when I did my shipwreck trek, because I wanted to just double check what I had mentioned or what I had brought on for shipwreck trek. I obviously don't have this at the top of my head, but you know when they used to do the shipwreck on 10 Forward, Lou, it will please you to know that I shipwrecked Similitude from Enterprise, E-Squared from Enterprise, which is the one with the second ship that comes back from 80 years in the future with old T'Pol. I shipwrecked Unimatrix Zero, which is horrendous, absolutely horrendous, and no redeeming features whatsoever. I shipwrecked Space Seed. And I can't remember my fifth one was.
Shipwrecked Space Seed?
Yes, yeah, Space Seed is a very overrated episode.
Netherlands, man. It's the Netherlands effect.
Oh, my God. What have you been drinking?
Oh, and then I shipwrecked Timeless. And I have absolutely no problem with Timeless being shipwrecked. That's a dreadful episode.
So, Luke, when you do the S9...
Mm-hmm.
And you move on to the other franchises. Who's replacing James?
I'm not sure at this point because I like Timeless and I don't know what to make of that one. But okay,
Timeless is the one with what's it? Future Chakotay and Harry Kim going. Yeah. Oh yeah, I've been moping around for the last 45 years. What I want to do is I want to go back to this ice cube. Come off it. Come off.
James, is your wife in shouting range?
Yes, nearly.
Come out and get her to check that you're not a changeling?
No, look, so here's the problem with Timeless. One episode that is a great episode, that has got very similar themes to Timeless, is The Visitor in DS9. And that's great episode, and that's done really well with a great sense of humanity and personal story. Timeless is written by a dude who probably overheard that someone had written The Visitor and didn't quite get the gist of the story, and it. I mean, maybe maybe when I have some spare time, I can do a proper thesis on why Timeless is such a poor clone of The Visitor. I mean, I've always threatened my wife with at some point I'm going to quit my job and take up some academic studies, and the one that I keep threatening her with is a proper full dissertation on why the remake of The Day the Earth Stood Still is such a crime to culture. But I could also do a couple on, you know, why did DS9, you know, certain DS9 episodes.
I'll agree with you on why the Earth Stood Still.
I mean, it was just an absolute disgrace. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'll definitely agree with you on that one.
Okay. You know, I'm going to have to go back to the Delta Quadrant and see what they did, what they said about Timeless. I'd like to know what they did.
Oh, everyone loves Timeless because it's like an action-y film. It's an action adventure. Stuff happens. And I think that sometimes we should distinguish between the stuff happening and stuff being good. And, you know, every now and again there'll be episodes where stuff doesn't happen. But you can, like, stand back and think, actually, that was, like, a really small story, very well told.
You don't have to have pew, pew, bang, bang to have a good episode.
No. So, I mean, you know, we've done Data's Day. I think things like In the Cards on DS9, it's extremely small story that's extremely well told. You know, certain, like, bottle episodes, like Armageddon Game on DS9 is basically just the development of the Bashir O'Brien relationship when they're caught with those harvesters. And again, it's a great James. Little story. Go on, Colin.
You did say your wife would only be an hour.
Yeah, did I really?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's not possible. It's never happened before. Okay, one thing I didn't like about Timeless is pretty much Harry. I didn't like the he was just an ass. Anyway, so back on the ship, so I was talking about the balance, and of course we go back to the ship, and when we come back to Cayman, 5 years has passed, and he's still trying to figure out that life. You know, she says, you know, in all the stories that you've told me, I've never heard one that it's as good as your life now. Do you think he told her about the Borg?
No.
I wonder how that went.
No, I don't think you told her about the Borg at all.
Okay. So, but like I said, I like the balance between the Catan and the Enterprise. So, pretty cool stuff. And you know one thing I really did dig, and I don't know why, is the naming ceremony. Somehow I really find that very charming, very sweet, is the naming ceremony. What do you guys think about it?
You Catholic, Lou?
Yeah.
Awesome.
But I've never seen a naming ceremony. I mean, nobody knows this baby's name, you know, for the first month or two of its life. And
the only reason I said about the Catholic, because it reminded me of baptisms and christenings.
Mm-hmm. Yep. It's like a baptism, you're right.
Yeah.
But everybody knows the name of the child being baptized.
Yeah, beforehand, yeah.
But I'm saying this naming ceremony where, you know, everybody gets together and, you know, they reveal the name of this baby. I think it's a cute little ceremony.
Can you imagine the Vulcans doing that with everyone's name beginning with T?
Yeah. Well, that'd be interesting. So put on like a chalkboard or something. Baby's name is, and then the letter T hyphen. We don't know what's going to be after T. But anyway,
or the Klingons ones, because they all start with a K.
Yeah. How did Worf become Worf then?
He was raised by humans, remember?
But he was named Worf by Molg, I would imagine.
Yeah,
who also isn't a K. Or Gowron isn't a K.
No,
or the Duras. Anyway.
Yeah, but that collaborates.
Yeah. They're all wrong. So during the ceremony, Cayman goes into a seizure, which is actually Riker trying to cut the puppet strings. And again, we go back to the planet after Picard is... We go back to the planet and Maribor, who was, 3 years old, 4 years old during the ceremony, now is... either a very old teenager or is an adult herself, but she knows this planet's dying. And I don't know, I kind of liked the way Kamen's trying to divert the topic. Hey.
Yeah, it was a nice touch and all, though, because the program adapted to them trying to resuscitate him in the real world.
Yes.
So, that, you know, I like the way that the program adapted and they showed that in his world as well. So it kept it all flowing for him.
And it would have had to have been adaptive because the... You know, because halfway through this second life of Picard, he kind of gets horny and thinks he needs to have some kids. Or he gets this at least he gets broody and feel like he has to have some kids.
So that this also plays into what we know about Picard, because he says, like, you know, that he regretted not having kids.
Yeah, but okay. So if you were to have lived through this, right, for like, you know, 35, 40 years of your life, and then someone says to you, "Oh, you know, any regrets?" He goes, "Oh, yeah, regret not having kids." Would perhaps, you know, shouldn't these kids just feel as real to him as any other kids, right? I mean, he raised them.
Yeah, because he spent 40 years with them.
He spent a long time with you, and he had grandkids. Now, you know, yeah, you can't go and find them now. But other than if he's on a starship, he's not going to really have, you know, personal contact with these kids ad infinitum anyway. So, why doesn't he feel as connected to these kids?
I'm sure he does. Do you think maybe he's got PTSD because he lost the children that he raised on that planet, just like as if they'd been killed?
Well, I certainly think that he probably needs some type of therapy after he's been through with this. Now, you mentioned a scene with what was her name? Meridor?
What's Maribor.
Maribor. I think one of the problems with the episode, because they're having to shuffle forward a lot, they do have, I mean, the clumsy writing, or at least the writing that is slightly they've been too explicit in stuff they're putting on into words. So there is the bit where during the naming ceremony, he specifically turns to his wife. He says that, okay, first of all, we're going to call this baby after Batai, who's gone. And you think, okay, I can just about understand that would be mentioned in context if you're naming your son after a friend that you had lost. But then he mentions that, oh, I felt so nervous when we had Mirabor's name in ceremony, I nearly dropped her. So at least again, it drops the name, it drops the fact that there's another kid. And then when they fast forward, they then drop the name of the kid again. And the way that they just phrase a lot of this, which is, oh, haven't you grown very quickly kind of thing, to me, it just seems a little clunky, and I accept that you have to have something there, because otherwise, people aren't going to, you know, they're not designed to be catching up with these 15-year increments every 2 minutes. But it's something that didn't quite feel right to me. Now I don't have any solutions.
We're getting 15-year increments, but he's not.
Yeah, which is what, but a lot, which is why when he uses words and he specifically turns to his daughter and says, "Oh yes, my daughter." It feels slightly forced, because in his world,
oh, like it's reinforcing it to the viewer. Yes, this is my daughter.
Indeed.
Yeah.
Indeed.
Well, yeah, that's all it's about.
And when he turns and says, "I taught you how to be a scientist," he said, "Well, I mean, what? She spent the last like 8 years learning the scientific method, and then just out of nowhere, in 8 years down the line, your dad turns around and says, 'I taught you to be a scientist.' I mean, it doesn't happen it doesn't flow fluidly."
No, I mean that's basically a narrative for the viewer.
Indeed, indeed.
You know, this is my daughter. I taught her to be a scientist.
There are better and worse ways to do it. And I thought the way they introduced the Thai child was okay, but when they started introducing with the daughter and I've taught her science and also to a certain extent the bit where, you know, Picard does say, "Hey, I need your permission to build something," and it's like, "Oh, you've never needed my permission to build things before," and it's like, "Oh no, this time you do." And again, it's slightly clunky. Now, I'm not saying it's dreadful, by the way, but I just felt that for something that is, I came into this perhaps hoping for a kind of a more fluid and a tighter script. Shut up, James.
No, it's not that. It's just, I mean, this. I know from reading up on it and stuff like that, because, I mean, I did, when I had Melodic Treks as a podcast, I did a Melodic Treks on this show because of the music. And yep. I know from that it had 8 rewrites. So they actually used as the broadcast script that had been messed with at least eight times. So some of the clunkiness might be due to constant rewrites.
That could be. All right.
But yeah, I did the bit where he's basically saying, I want to build baby stuff. Yeah, that didn't flow very good. I'll give you that. But the bit about his daughter and teaching the science and all that—that's just like, okay, he's reinforcing what's gone on while you've been back on the Enterprise type of thing.
And by the way, was I the only person that thought, okay, do we have to hand it to the program here that made all the people on the planet human-like, and potentially, you know, in a way that Picard plus wife could have children? They made all that human-like.
Right? No.
Here that it happens to be the case that the planet's exactly as human.
Well, no. I mean, it could just be that, like you said, it could be the program adapting to.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, because again, at back of my mind, I'm thinking, what are the chances of this?
Yeah, but I mean, this evening. Well, we do know that the progenitor seeded the entire universe. Which is why there's a lot of humanoid species. So it's not a leap of faith. I mean, you know, look at the Bajorans; they're basically human except for nose ridges.
Mm-hmm. No, I agree.
Go with the program adapting to the fact that it's a human that works.
I think it would have to be, and also I think the wife is too good for Picard. Maybe I'm wrong here.
Do you think he's punching above his weight?
Way above his weight. Plus the fact that I think that she's far too she's far too understanding of someone. I mean, so let's say that your significant other also woke up saying, "I spent the last 25 years on a spaceship." I mean, I'd kick them out in a matter of a week if they kept going on about it. It sounds like she put up with it for 5 years. I mean, far too good for him.
Well, that could have also been down to the program.
Again, indeed, and that's the thing. Once you have, you know, when you happen to land in a relationship with a lady like that, who is that understanding, I start thinking, like, at least, at very least, like Truman Show-esque goings-on that are conspiring against you, if not worse.
So do you think the atmospheric condenser thing...
I think they nicked that from Star Wars.
Do they?
Well, that's what Luke was doing early on Tatooine. His uncle was a atmospheric farmer or something like that. They had atmospheric condensers.
But it's all perfectly reasonable. If you've got a very moist atmosphere, you just find a way of getting the air out of the atmosphere. And it doesn't have to be particularly tricky, right? Or you don't need much. You need a flow of air to go through a cold patch, and as soon as the steam or the air droplets in the air get reduced in temperature by enough, they'll fall into physical water and just collect. So I think that should be perfectly reasonable.
So we can have moist air in a drought.
Well, I think that's the whole point, right? It's that there's a lot of water vapor in the air because a lot of the water has evaporated from the sea, and it's just staying up.
Yeah, it's not that there's no clouds. There's no rain.
Mm-hmm. And no doubt there'll be like storms, right? That's the suggestion here would be that there's. It's stormier weather.
They never said that they was losing their atmosphere. They just said that there was like a planet-wide drought.
Right. Well, I think Kamen figured out what was happening. What was happening? Was it the sun too close? Was the planet getting too close to the sun? What was causing it?
Well, they came at the end. I think Data mentioned that the star went nova, which is just the it is just water. It's just like a dying phase of the of the sun. So what that would just be, it would expand and then it would collapse in on itself. So to me, it sounded like it was in the point where the sun was just getting bigger and getting hotter for this particular planet.
So tell me what happened to them in the end. Did they all just blow up?
So it's very likely that basically the atmosphere and the people on the planet just got burnt off the planet, unfortunately. Mm. So during its dying phase, I think it's clear that I might not be 100% accurate here, but I've seen projections at least that as our sun expands in its latter life, it should engulf the Earth and basically just burn the entirety of the planet, and I think Mars as well.
So that's a red giant.
Yeah,
red giant. Yeah.
So that's basically,
Betelgeuse is.
So basically, we'll just be standing there and we'll actually watch it happen and boom, we'll be vaporized.
No. Well, hopefully we won't be here then.
Hopefully.
Mankind. I would hope by then mankind's left the planet.
Well, you're going to have to. You had two choices.
You want to leave the planet or die, yeah.
Yeah. But also, it's not going to be an immediate thing, right? It's not going to go bang and then that's it. It's going to be a gradual
increase. We've got a few billion years, haven't we?
I don't quite know.
Well, anyway, in a bit of unnecessary addition to the storyline, his son, Batai, is going to drop out of school because he wants to follow his music. Which, yeah, whatever. Let him do what he wants. We're all dying anyway. That's pretty much the attitude I got from Picard.
Yeah, follow your dreams. Because if you don't follow your dreams, then what else have you got to do for? Because we're all going to die anyway.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's a slightly nihilistic attitude. I thought that it was slightly... I would like to believe that... he was slightly more conciliatory than that. Than just, you do whatever you like with your life. You basically have 12 days left.
That's what it seemed like to me. He was admitting, we ain't got much time left anyway. Why should I stop him?
Yeah, but the thing is they all know they're dying. They all know they got 12 days left, yet no one went on a mad shopping spree.
And there was no murders, no looting.
No crime explosion. No looting.
No cop cars turned upside down.
No. No armed police on the streets. Everyone was very calm and collected about the fact that we're all going to die.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Okay. So then eventually, what did his wife die of?
Ooh.
I remember she had surgery at one point, but I don't remember what it was that she was suffering from.
So let me just ask just a quick question about this program. If this program is supposed to be something that the civilization sent out in order to teach, or in order, at very least, so people would remember them, this is an adaptive program that allows Picard to live a life on the planet, and it ends, as he sees the thing blowing off in his old age, which is all great. Why does it have to show his best friend dying, no doubt a horrendous death, whilst being mugged or something, and him losing his wife? Why does it have to show that? That sounds like a terrible...
His wife died of old age.
No, she was like...
No.
He had 40 years on her.
Seemed like it.
No, I've just literally just looked on Memory Alpha. It says his wife died of old age.
Wow. That's funny.
Not buying it.
No, I did not get that impression. I think she, because she had to have surgery a little bit ago. It
says on the air, Elaine dies a natural death.
Mm.
So,
okay.
I think the funniest thing about this entire episode is the fact that they showed Patrick Stewart what he would look like in 40 years' time. And if you look at him now, he's not going to look like that in 10 years' time. So.
No, I would hope not.
By the way, that's something I always enjoy. I always enjoy the, whether it's Riker in, what's the episode, Future Imperfect, or Riker...
When he's Admiral Riker.
Yeah, and mm-hmm. more in All Good Things. And you think, you know, All Good Things is... All Good Things, in terms of the canon timeline, is in the past to where we stand now, right? So you should be seeing these people, you know. You know, the All Good Things iteration is younger than, you know, the Jonathan Frakes and Patrick Stewart and the rest of them should be now. I think most of them look better than their projected selves.
Definitely. I still want to know where those flying cars are from 2015 and Back to the Future.
Yeah, and the hoverboards.
Yeah. Yeah, where's the hoverboard? What they call a hoverboard now makes
it's
no
not a hoverboard.
Sense.
No, I don't get that because he doesn't hover.
No.
So what do they call a hoverboard now?
It's like a two-wheeled scooter, basically.
Yeah. It's like a Segway that doesn't have...
You lean forward to go forward and you lean back to stop.
No, that's not a hoverboard.
That's not a hoverboard. It's got wheels. It doesn't hover. It's got wheels. So they call them hoverboards because they wanted to cash in on the Back to the Future thing, I suppose. But no, they don't hover. They've got a thing with them anyway. They've had loads of recalls on them because they keep bursting into flames.
Yeah, a lot of places won't let them in. No, we don't want fires in our building. Okay. So the wife dies, and just as she dies, that's when, or actually it was a little while after she died, that he's playing with his grandchildren, and his son comes and says, "Hey, Kami, let's go watch the launching." "The what? The launching? What damn launching? Nobody told me." What do you think of old Picard's old man attitude?
I quite like his old man attitude, to be
honest. I was going to say I quite like his old man attitude, yeah.
Yeah, I always
if
say...
If anyone's got a really old grandfather, then yeah, that was him.
Oh, yeah. I always say, I hope I don't get like that when I get that old. It seems like every old fart you talk to these days has got a real bad chip on their shoulder. This growly kind of guy. I hope I don't become that way. But I probably will. And so they go to the launching. And what's this launching for? Well, you ought to know. You saw it. So how do you like the reintroduction of Batai and his wife? James, I'm getting the impression you don't really care for it.
No, not at all. Not at all. This is a heartbreaking scene, right? This is you.
Yeah.
You've kind of like followed through the episode. You've seen the guy grow, and you've seen, and now you're introduced basically all of his, all of his dead relatives. I'm a big fan of Tim Burton's film Big Fish, and it very much reminds me of kind of the last sequence that they have in that. That is also kind of like, extremely emotional. And as they do this, there'd be something wrong with you if you thought, nah, not having any of this. It's like very nice and wonderfully done. It's a little cheap, right? In the sense that basically you're saying, hey, our entire civilization has died, but as long as we've been able to talk to you and you can remember us, we'll feel kind of warm inside. You know, that's quite a burden to place on anyone. But it's certainly, it's certainly very nice.
I wonder if Picard wrote everything down that happened, created some kind of history book for it. Well, anyway. Okay, so the launch goes up, and next thing you know, he wakes up on the ship, and again, he's all confused, Dr. Crusher. Yeah. I'm Jean-Luc Picard.
He sounds like he's had a good Friday night.
You think? What do you mean? What does that mean?
Well, you've had a few drinks and you talk slurry.
Well, yeah, but he was completely confused.
Yeah, well, he's just spent 40 years on another planet.
That makes sense. And you know something that's even weird is just... Not last night, but the night before last night, I had the craziest dream. I had a dream that I was in a weird house. I was in a bigger house. I couldn't go into the house through the front door. I could only get into the back door, which actually was the upper level of my favorite restaurant, Malara's. And you have to go up into the ceiling of Malara's to get to my house. And I was on the second floor of my house, which is wobbly floor. So I had to try and find an area that wouldn't drop me down to the lower level. It was very, very strange. And as I woke up, I distinctly remember I had no idea where I really lived. I couldn't tell you for the life of me what my house looked like for about 10 minutes after I woke up.
So this was after you woke up?
Yeah. After I woke up, I was completely confused as to what house I live in. It was almost like that house was real. And you have to get into it through the back door, which is actually, you know, you have to crawl up into the ceiling of Malara's to get to my house. And it just seemed so real. And it took me a while to actually realize what my real house looked like. And that was just bizarre and strange. You ever have that happen to you?
Not me. I was going to suggest a control or delete restart for something like that.
Yeah.
If you try turning it off and on again.
Yeah. Go back to a previous, you know, time when I knew what I was doing. But it was a very bizarre dream. But what I'm saying is it makes sense because I woke up not even realizing I had no idea what my real house looked like until I had to sit down and actually think about it for a second. And now, can you imagine him? He's lived 40 years in this 20 minutes. And to him, the Enterprise was just a distant memory.
Well, in the program, he actually, you know, basically forgot about the Enterprise.
Yeah, he did. So, I don't know.
By the way, in complete fairness, I know I've been critical of him kind of coming back and being chirpy by the end of the episode and, you know, being back on duty. But I suppose, you know, the program does expose itself to be a program to him, and it helps him through this, you know, breaking down reality.
I don't think he did come back and be chirpy, though, because you have that moment in the cabin. I mean, the only proof he's got that this entire thing happened is the flute.
Yes.
No, sure, but I think that
when he's in the cabin with the flute and he plays it, he gets remorseful.
But first of all, the fact that the flute exists, the fact that they were able, you know, he was able to go back to what he remembered pre-waking up. You know, no doubt he doesn't have any memories of himself as a child on the planet. The fact that, you know, his best friend and his wife and stuff appeared to him in his, you know, in the latter stages and, like, helped him transition back to his quote-unquote normal life. You know, I think all that, like, helped him be able to pick up. I do think he picks up a little bit too quickly. but I'm just being, you know, being picky on that one.
I don't think he, you know, we don't know how long is between now and time zero. I mean, it could be 3-4 months. So he could have been in intense therapy for the whole time. He went back to his quarters. And to me, what I got was a profound loneliness now. Yes. He's on a ship of, you know, 1,000 people. He's in command of this big ass ship. But he is so lonely right now because his wife is not there. His friend is not there. His children and grandchild, everything he now lived for is gone. And he had to somehow let that go and become a part of this life again. I don't know. I think Troy had a lot of work to do between now and time zero.
And it's not like he could go even to the planet to pay, you know, to look, because the planet's gone.
It's gone, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, he can't, yeah, you're right. I assume the entire planet is gone, right? Everything was blown into space dust?
Yep, would have been.
So he can't even go back and see what it looked like. The only thing he could do is maybe get Q to take him back in time when he was there, which I think would have also made an interesting story.
Yeah, but there wouldn't have been nothing in it for Q.
No, of course not.
So he wouldn't have done it.
No, no. So no, I don't think he just picked up. No, you're just, you're, I mean, you know,
you,
I think
you don't, if you take the best of both worlds and then the repercussions of being assimilated, they deal with that in the episode after.
Family. Yep.
Yeah. You know, he goes back, he has breaks down, he starts crying in front of his brother and stuff like that. Cause they deal with that in that episode.
Yeah. So they don't need to do it again.
No. And they also bring it up in First Contact because you know, when he's fighting the Borg in First Contact in a movie, he brings that up again about what they did to him and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So I can kind of see what James is saying about the fact that there's no lasting repercussions from losing a family, children, friends, and 40 years of existence. But it's just, it does carry it with him because it comes up in lessons, you know, mm-hmm. and he makes references to it in lessons, you know. So it's not dealt with the way that his PTSD is dealt with after the Best of Both Worlds, but it is kind of dealt with in lessons.
Mm. Well, anyway, so that brings us to the end of the episode. And of course, you know, the very last part, we see the ship riding off into the sunset with the Picard playing the flute. And I love that last part. I've always loved that sound that they do. And that's the reason why I have used that ending flute play for the Lou Trek show since 2009 when I started. And every single episode that I've produced, at least I believe, maybe not in the first couple until I realized it was there. But yes, I have always ended every single show with that flute. Yeah,
and it had such a resonance with the fans that they did a full orchestral version of it.
Yes. Yeah.
So that's you know, Jay Chataway composed a full orchestral treatment of it because the fans wanted that. That's how you listen to that, James. This is how popular this episode is.
Mm-hmm. So it's yeah. more evidence. That's fine. More evidence out there that suggests I'm subjectively wrong. Objectively wrong, not subjectively wrong.
I don't think you're wrong per se. You know, everybody's got their own beliefs on what is and what isn't. It's not a one or a zero. There has to be some room in between. So, not a problem. So, I guess that brings us to our final thoughts and ratings on this episode, where we're going to rate this on a scale of 4 to 5, with 4 being the worst. Nah. All right. 5. I'm giving you a chance out.
Just switch them around so James gives it a 5.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. With 4 being the best and 5 being somewhat okay. No. Okay, 1 is the worst, 5 is the best. And Colin, as our guest, I want you to go first, please.
Well, personally, I love this episode. I've done, like I said at the start, I like music from it that much. I did an episode of Melodic Treks purely dedicated to the music of this episode. I love the fact that we get to see Patrick Stewart acting his chops off, working with his son, his real-life son as well. It's just a strong, powerful performance from Patrick Stewart. I'm sure there's people who like it because Wesley Crusher's not in it. I'm sure there's people who like it because you know it's Patrick Stewart basically all on his own. But me personally, I think it shows a side of Picard that he tries to keep under lock and key because he's a Starfleet officer. He's dedicated his life to Starfleet. He hasn't had children. He hasn't had a family. He doesn't have children. He doesn't have a family. We see later on in the films that he, you know, when his son, he says that he didn't feel the need to have children because his brother did. So the family line was secure. And this episode shows some of them regrets that he's been keeping bottled up. So we get to see a side of Picard that we wouldn't normally see if it wasn't for this episode. I love the music. I just love this episode. I think it's a brilliant episode. Yes, there's a few things wrong with it, but yeah, I can live with them. So yeah, I'd give this a 5.
Okay. Yeah, and I found that Melodic Treks number 2, The Pied Piper of Catan, from January of 2014. Fascinating. So that's been 4 years since you did that, and I didn't know anything about it until you mentioned it, and I see it now, so I'll have to look into that one. And of course, if I can remember, I'll put that in the show notes along with the Gamma Quadrant, the Delta Quadrant, and
everything else we mentioned.
Yeah, I was going to say, I'm not exactly sure. You know, how's Trek News and Views going?
It's not.
You know, maybe someday you're going to get that back again. Okay, I want this show to end on a positive note. So, James, you go next.
Okay, I'd be happy to. By the way, just to be clear, when I say I think this episode's overrated, I didn't think it's a bad episode at all. And this isn't me, like, false praising the episode for a given a 2 or anything like that. I think there's a lot of good stuff in this episode. I think that Patrick Stewart has got a very good performance in this episode. I have to say that I'm not in... Colin, you mentioned he obviously acts next to his son, who clearly isn't an actor, because he's not that great, right? I mean, he might have...
No, your son is an actor in real life.
No, he's not an actor in real life.
Your son is an actor in real life.
Look, if that's true, then this must have been his first job.
No, seriously, Daniel Stewart is an actor in real life.
Okay, I'll remain to be convinced on that. So I think Patrick Stewart's great in this episode. Of course, I do like the fact that you're able to like pose these kind of questions on Star Trek, and I have mentioned on numerous occasions how these things are very. This episode's a very Star Trek-y episode, right? You know, dude falls down, relives an entire lifetime as an echo of a fallen civilization, and you know, learns from it, and we all kind of like follow him along on the emotional journey. So, from that perspective, it is good and it is interesting, and it does ask some certain questions. I don't think it gets as deep as I would have liked, and I don't think that the script is as tight as I would have liked. But it's certainly a very ambitious production, and you know, we have to remember, of course, that this is, you know, we're still in the, you know, this is the sequel to Star Trek. They would never have attempted anything like this on TNG, and the fact that I can think of a few episodes on DS9 where they might have had similar concepts that might have been executed better shouldn't really take away from the fact that this was the first time they were attempting to do anything like this. Almost the entirety of the story is off ship, off bridge, and it's not really interacting with any bad guys or anything like that. So, kind of like a good step forward for the series, certainly.
You mean TOS?
Yeah. What did I mention before?
You said TNG.
Okay. They wouldn't have ever done this on TOS, and the fact that this is as TNG is as its only sequel at this point, I think it's kind of certainly getting its legs, and it's been more ambitious in its in its storytelling. I have no problem giving this episode a 4 out of 5. I think that's where I would honestly rate it. I don't see it as being quite the top notch of TNG, but it's certainly it certainly doesn't suck. So 2 thumbs up from me. Hey Lou, you thought I was coming in lower, didn't you?
No, I put you at a 4.
Oh, okay. Then take it down 2 notches.
You're not gonna go to a 2. I wouldn't even let you go to a 2. So, okay.
Hang on, Luke,
so
Luke, before you start, just let me tell James while you was talking. I looked Daniel Stewart up on IMDb.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
He's got 10 acting credits to his name.
Okay. When did it start?
Let's go back. 1986, sorry, is his first acting credit.
As what? As what? Baby One or something?
I don't know. It's Shaka Zulu.
Hold on. This Inner Light was 1992, so that 1996 can't be his first.
86.
86. Oh, okay. 86. Yeah.
86 was his first one, and his last one was 2016.
Hmm. Okay.
Sorry to interrupt.
Well, you know, okay,
You are right. Look, I will admit he clearly had a paying acting job before getting The Inner Light. It does look like it. I'm surprised. If I ever meet him in person, I'll apologize.
Ah, right. Okay. Yeah, born in 1967. Huh? Well, whatever. Okay, so. So why do I? Okay, I'm going to explain why I do believe this episode is more like a 3 episode. I'm lying, by the way. This is my number one Star Trek of all time. I'm sorry, I like it. I do like it. And the Pale Moonlight, good one. And the City on the Edge of Forever, great one. Shades of Grey. Okay. But this is my number one. I think it's a remarkable story. It's a beautiful story. Great script. I think I like the pacing of the events. I think it's good. I can't find any flaws in this, really. I don't even think I did any goofy nitpicking like I usually do in most episodes. I always find those few things that I can laugh about and say, hey, right, yeah, Picard walks into a burning cord or whatever. But here, I can't really find anything. Did I do any nitpicking that you guys can think of? No, me either.
No.
So, in my opinion, this is, we say one for the worst and five stars for the best. And I think, even though we've given a lot of five-star reviews, none of them I consider to be the best, like I considered this to be the best. I'm just a sucker for these kind of heartfelt stories. And that's where I am with this one here.
Well, I mean, Lou, if you feel that way, I can't wait for us to review Masks, because no doubt it's going to be a similar situation, right?
Masks? No.
James, you're not seriously comparing Masks to these.
I mean, it can't
be sure. On paper, it's almost the same story.
Oh, my God.
No. No.
You're going to get so much hype, Bill.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I may have to actually put this on the forum just to see what they said, what they think about what you're doing.
I like,
because as you can tell, I quit using the forum. I don't know why. Well, I mean, we're getting nothing. Even Kieran McDuff ditched us on the forum, boys. So I'm like, I'm done with the forums. So let's see. In the end, it's heartfelt and it's heartbreaking at the same time. And I believe this changes Picard in more ways than even the Borg did. So obviously that's a five. You know it's a five. Well, James, you don't know it's a five, but everybody else does.
No, but he went a four. That's, you know, thought he was going to go a three, to be honest.
Oh no, I didn't think he'd go that low. I didn't think he was that crazy. But it's to me, it's this is one of the best Star Treks that have ever been made. So this would be on my not shipwreck, but
Desert Island.
And it probably did make my Desert Island. I have no idea which ones I chose for that.
Did you ever do a Desert Island?
Yes, I think I did. I'm pretty sure I did.
You did one with Brian.
Yeah, and they changed the rules or something. Like, you're supposed to pick 10 or something, but because we had too many people, we weren't able to pick as many or something like that. I don't remember what it was, but yeah, I do believe this would have been happily on my Desert Island. This is my Wilson ball of the Desert Island. So are we all hip on that?
Yep.
No, I have no idea what a Wilson ball is.
Really? Tom Hanks? What's it called? Stranded?
Football, yeah.
Soccer ball. I don't know. What was it called?
It's not called Stranded. It's Castaway.
Castaway, that's it.
Yeah.
Castaway. So this is the Wilson ball.
Yeah.
You might as well call it, whoops, I fell off a boat and I landed on an island somewhere.
He didn't fall off a boat. He fell off a plane.
Yeah.
It's a flying
He was the
boat.
Only sole survivor. Him and Wilson were the only survivors of that plane crash. So, okay. So that is The Inner Light, folks. So, Colin, what do you think? You want to do another one?
Yeah. What? Now? After taking 2.5 hours to do this one?
Yeah. I'm sorry, but we have drafted you. We're gonna bring you on and a good Scotsman, and you both are gonna come talk about the next two episodes called Redemption. And
no,
Redemption.
It's not Redemption.
No,
Lou,
shit.
Lou, come on.
Redemption?
That's not Redemption, Lou. Redemption. I'm in the wrong series.
Redeem yourself.
Stop, Lou. Redemption. That was last year. Make that Time's Arrow Part 1 and 2. God. Redemption. Here, I went back to look at other fives that we were given when I said we were getting a lot of fives, but. And I stopped at Redemption. I don't know. Brian gave it a 4.5. Colin, what do you think Redemption is?
I don't think it's a 5.
You do?
No.
No? So what is it?
Probably a 4.
That's what we thought too, right, James?
I can't remember.
A 4. You gave it a 4.
Yeah, I'll give it a 4. I wouldn't give it a 5. I'll give it a 4.
Yeah, I said 4. James said 4. And Brian said 4.5. But then Redemption Part 2. Remember that one, James?
Yeah, with Data.
No. It was Brian. It was the same. We always use the same guest for Part 2.
No. I mean with Data, the android taking over the ship.
Yes. The Sutherland.
The Sutherland.
Yeah. We gave that one a 3.
So we titled off from Part 1 to Part
2. Yes. Yeah. Part 1 was better than Part 2.
We'll see what happens with Time Zero then, see if that tiles off between 1 and 2.
Yeah, we'll see, won't we? All right. So, since it's a 2-part, it's going to be a little difficult to get us all on again with Kieran McDuff. Chris is his real name. Guys, I hope it's a week after you listen to this one, but I'm not so sure it's going to be. So, sorry about that. Bear with us.
As soon as we can all sync up.
Yeah, we're going to try. Maybe in the next couple weeks, but it's going to be tough with 4 different people. And all right. So thank you again, Colin, for coming on. And go carefully. Go carefully, Colin.
On the next exciting episode of Star Trek The Next Generation.
It seems clear that my life is to end in the late 19th century.
Data faces a shocking fate.
We've lost him.
And embarks on a mission of no return.
I'm not willing to accept that he's dead and just leave it at that.
Now, to bring him back alive.
My God.
The crew must cross a chilling gateway into terror.
Data!
Next time on Star Trek The Next Generation.
Oh, yeah, so join us next time as we review episode number 26, and that's going to be Time's Arrow Part 1 with Colin and Kieran McDuff. So, like I said, go carefully, everyone, and good night.
Okay, good night.
And again, Colin.
Good night.